I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
The hospital is oftentimes going to be writing off losses when they go to the emergency room, and so it's going to put a lot of pressure on our healthcare system.
The impact the budget reconciliation bill could have on local hospitals. Expert analysis on the federal healthcare spending measures.
We saw depression decrease. We saw health outcomes increase for them. And then for their children, we saw educational outcomes increase.
As states begin to implement measures of the Big Beautiful Bill, we look at the positive impact work requirements for Medicaid and other safety net programs have on families.
We need to have reasonable immigration enforcement. We can't just treat everyone the same.
Welcoming in the stranger while also protecting our borders. Former Chief Counsel for Immigration and Customs Enforcement provides his perspective on the Trump administration's border policy.
A round of applause from Republicans after President Donald Trump signed the budget reconciliation bill on July 4th, a day after the final version passed in the House. The so-called Big Beautiful Bill is already facing a lawsuit. We'll get to that in a moment. The legislation contains about $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, including no tax on overtime or tips, increased deductions for state and local taxes, and boosts to the child tax credit. It expands education savings plans and offers deductions on loans of American-made cars. The bill also increases spending on immigration enforcement and the military. One major pro-life win was the defunding of Planned Parenthood for 1 year. Pro-life leaders briefly celebrated the win.
I know it's not everything we want. It's only defunding Planned Parenthood for 1 year, and it's about 80% of their federal funds, so about $500 million they just lost. They just lost.
The celebration was short-lived, however, because Planned Parenthood sued the government. And on Monday, a judge blocked the defunding for 14 days. The bill is facing major criticism for its massive reductions to Medicaid. Hospitals are warning the cuts could cause nationwide closures of rural hospitals. Democrats and church leaders say the impact will be devastating.
17 million people in our country, 17 million Americans in our country are going to lose their Medicaid.
Archbishop Timothy Broglio, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, issued a statement saying in part, quote, "The final version of the bill includes unconscionable cuts to health care, cuts to programs to protect God's creation. The bill, as passed, will cause the greatest harm to those who are especially vulnerable in our society," unquote. Daniel Cruz, co-founder and CEO of Presidio Healthcare, joins us now. He has written policy proposal papers advocating for excluding abortion from healthcare coverage. Daniel, can you tell us about the healthcare spending proposals you were a part of? What made it into the bill and what did not?
Yes, thanks for having me on. I worked for an organization called Paragon Health Institute as an independent actuary. As part of their research team that really formed a lot of the basis for some of these healthcare proposals that ended up in the bill. Now, the backdrop for all of the proposals is really that, you know, federal healthcare spending is about a quarter of our overall federal budget. It's expected to increase and is really one of the primary drivers of future instability with our future federal budget. And so, you know, proponents of the bill will say, and really the research concluded that after the pandemic, federal healthcare spending rose about 25% from its baseline. That's about $1.9 trillion over 10 years. And the proposals really sought to roll back that $1.9 trillion increase in spending after the pandemic. And what the research found was that really two areas contributed mostly to that rise in spending. One was perverse incentives within these federal programs that allowed for waste, fraud, and abuse. And the second was really there was a loosening of eligibility requirements for people accessing both Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And so that's really what forms the basis of a lot of these proposals that got into the bill. The biggest one that is probably least controversial is the curtailing of what we call provider tax schemes, where states were taxing hospitals, returning the tax money right back to the hospitals, and then collecting the federal matching dollars that they would get through the Medicaid program. So that was really a bulk of the spending cuts there. Over $300 billion will come from that. The more controversial pieces are going to be the eligibility requirements, tightening them up. On one hand, they're asking the states to have more requirements, more check-in points for making sure people are eligible for Medicaid or for the ACA enrollment, which obviously is going to have an impact on families that rely upon those programs. But at the same time, it curtails bad actors like insurance agents that are signing people up who are truly not eligible, who sometimes don't even know that they're getting signed up for insurance while the insurance agents are collecting a lot of commissions. Now, the most controversial aspect is the work requirements that are being added to Medicaid enrollees, specifically the adult expansion enrollees that do not have dependent children. That is probably the single largest amount of savings that proponents of the bill would argue for is a rational piece to it, but that's certainly the most controversial aspect of people losing coverage in those scenarios.
Now, the Catholic Church has sought to preserve the right to basic health care while responsibly stewarding resources. How will the health care provisions of the bill impact access to health care, and at what cost?
This is the big question, and this is, right now, everything is projections. The CBO projected around 16 million people may lose health care coverage through this bill. Part of that is actually not even in the bill. Part of that is just the sunsetting of what was enhanced federal subsidies on the Obamacare marketplaces that are called the ARPA enhanced subsidies are not being extended next year. Part of that is going to be those that are going to be subject to these work requirements. Now, just a reminder on the work requirements, they are only for able-bodied adults who don't have dependent children or illnesses. So that's going to impact, roughly 2 to 4 million Americans on those programs. But the bigger context is, especially for hospital systems, is that this is revenue that they will not be able to get anymore. A lot of these times, these people may become uninsured. And if they're uninsured, the hospital is oftentimes going to be writing off losses when they go to the emergency room. And so it's going to put a lot of pressure on our healthcare system, on hospitals that are no longer going to receive those funds through these Medicaid patients. So obviously, we have a balance of fiscal responsibility for future generations at the federal level. We'll see where actual numbers come. CBO has overprojected many times in the past in terms of enrollment, but certainly there will be an increase in uninsured and more people not getting access to these programs.
Well, Daniel, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we are joined in the studio today by Les Ford with Alliance for Opportunity to discuss how the bill affects safety net programs. Les, you've written extensively on work requirements for safety net programs and how these have helped low-income families, Americans, move out of poverty. Can you give us an overview of what you found and like the impacts of work requirements have on safety net programs?
Yeah, so we had a major move towards work requirements in the 1996 welfare reform. A lot of people are familiar with it. So before the 1996 reform, when I was investigating this, we saw a lot of dependency on cash benefits. 1 in 7 American children were in families completely dependent on the program. And so what you really see there is you see them pushed to the sidelines of society. You don't see them at the heart of our communities. And then when work requirements were instituted, and it was in a bipartisan way, this was Bill Clinton, this was Newt Gingrich, and they created a work requirement for the first time for these families, we actually saw incredible results. We saw incredible economic results. For instance, single mothers moved into work from like the 50% to the 70%, so that's wonderful. But the most important piece was that child poverty actually declined by 60% in 8 years alone. So we saw incredible economic benefits. But it's not just that. We saw well-being increase. So when these single mothers who are head of their household. When they moved to work, we saw depression decrease. We saw health outcomes increase for them. And then for their children, we saw educational outcomes increase. We saw the abortion rate actually flatten and even decline. So we see all of these holistic, important outcomes for society. And I think it's important that when we're looking at work requirements for adults, which is really what we're looking at in the Medicaid space right now, that we don't view work as a punishment. We view it as a way to bring more opportunity for the people who are sitting on the sidelines of our society. So that's a really important focus when we're thinking about work requirements.
I think that's a great way to put it, being on the sidelines versus at the center of American life. Now, there are stricter work requirements for those on Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, as well as Medicaid. What can we expect? What effects do you think we'll expect to see from this?
Yeah, so these two work requirements, so the one that happened in 1986, Welfare Reform 1.0, as I think we're going to start calling it, that was about single mothers who were dependent on cash welfare. And that program was one of 80-100 safety net programs. Now what we saw in the One Big Beautiful Bill, it's the next two largest welfare programs. So it's Medicaid for low-income people. It's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is food stamps for low-income folks. And the work requirement that is created is different in kind. It's really about able-bodied adults who aren't caregivers, who don't have young children in the home, and we're talking, it's really for only children, people who have children 15 years or older. And it's saying, hey, all we need you to do is part-time, 20 hours a week, go to work, do some training, participate in education. And when we've instituted these type of work requirements in the past, yeah, we see enrollment decrease, but we see incomes double or triple within 2 or 3 years. We see people go into more than 1,000 different industries. And then maybe their first job is a big box store or food service, but within the next year, they're moving even closer to their true talents. And so we see that dignity of work that we think is so important, we see that start to really flourish in their lives. So that's the goal. That's hopefully what we'll see.
Now, Alaska was eligible to apply for waivers to bypass these work requirements and is exempted from the requirement to contribute to the SNAP program for 2 years.
Yeah.
What are exemptions like these common, and what impact do they have?
They're only common when Lisa Murkowski is the 50th vote. So the 51st vote, who broke the tie, that was Vice President J.D. Vance. The 50th vote was the senator from Alaska, Lisa Murkowski. And she is an incredible negotiator for her state. And the reason she negotiated for the state is Alaska has actually a 60% error rate. And so she didn't want, and the SNAP state match is actually based on the error rate. So she said, let's give us a couple years to get our affairs in order, and hopefully they do before they actually are subject to the normal match rate. But it's not, you don't really want these special exemptions. Lisa Murkowski has been incredible in advocating for her state. But again, work requirements are not a punishment. A state match is not a punishment. It's really that principle of subsidiarity that in Catholic social teaching, where we want those who are closest to the problem, closest to people suffering, to be most engaged with those individuals. That's why a state match was created in this program. So Lisa Murkowski is an incredible negotiator. It's not something we want to see, but we hope that Alaska will make forward steps in lowering their error rate and bringing people back to work.
Les, thank you so much for explaining this to us today.
Yeah, hey, thank you for having me.
In Canada, a lawmaker has introduced a bill to stop the expansion of the medical aid in dying law from including mental illness as grounds to end one's life. Member of Parliament Tamara Jansen's bill would amend the criminal code to prevent mental disorders from being considered as grievous or irremediable medical condition for the purposes of the assisted suicide law. The Canadian government has delayed the expansion of including mental illness until March 17, 2027, after concerns raised by medical experts. According to the most recent annual report, which is from 2023, more than 15,000 people died by assisted suicide in Canada. Disability advocacy groups have filed a federal lawsuit challenging Colorado's assisted suicide law, claiming that the statute targets peoples with disabilities and other vulnerable groups.
We are seeking to a declaration that the law violates federal disability law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Rehabilitation Act, as well as the federal constitution.
They want a court to declare the law unconstitutional and block its enforcement permanently. Voters approved the medical aid in dying law in Colorado in 2016. When we return, the dignity of life and citizenship. We speak with the former chief counsel for Immigration and Customs Enforcement about his firsthand experience working with people seeking U.S. citizenship and his take on the Trump administration's immigration policies. The Supreme Court upheld a Texas law that limits access to pornography for minors. The law requires age verification to view pornography. A person must be 18 years old or older. Some challenged the rule as a violation of free speech rights, but justices ruled 6-3 that it does not violate the First Amendment. The court's majority found that Texas is within its authority to shield children from sexually explicit content and that this authority includes the power to require proof of age to access pornography. Texas is one of 24 states to have enacted age verification laws to access pornography online in recent years. We turn now to dive further into a story we brought you last week on another Supreme Court decision. Justices sided with the Trump administration by limiting lower courts' ability to block his executive orders with nationwide injunctions. Trump's order called for denying citizenship to the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants and temporary visitors. Justices didn't rule on Trump's order, but on the lower courts that had issued nationwide injunctions on the order. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that lower federal judges had overstepped their authority by imposing those injunctions. President Trump contends that the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to those born in the U.S., was intended solely for people of African descent and was never meant to extend citizenship universally to everyone born within the U.S. There are concerns being raised by many immigration rights organizations about the Department of Justice's memo, which was released in June, that asks agents to prioritize denaturalization. It states that the DOJ may revoke a person's citizenship if they illegally procured naturalization or willfully misrepresented who they are. It also states that they revoke citizenship of individuals who pose a threat to U.S. security, further unlawful enterprises of criminal gangs, as well as those who engage in war crimes, killings, or other serious human rights abuses, including human trafficking. Earlier, I had the opportunity to speak with Paul Hunker, a private attorney and former chief counsel for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in Dallas, Texas, about the Trump administration's border policies. Take a look. Paul, can we start with President Trump's claims about birthright citizenship? Is he accurate that its original intent was never meant to extend citizenship universally to everyone born in the U.S.?
Reading the wording of the amendment, Abby, it's clear that the amendment meant to say that if you're born in the States, you're a citizen of that state and you're a citizen of the United States. He's going to lose on the merits of the issue.
Now, many organizations are concerned about the ICE memo that calls for prioritizing denaturalization. Is there room for abuse by agents enacting this? And will naturalized citizens have due process, or do they have reason to fear?
Well, it's interesting, Abby. Often in the immigration world, the deck is stacked against us in representing non-citizens. The law is very favorable to the government. Often we have the burden to show the person merits relief or the person should get to stay here. But in the context of denaturalization, the government has the burden. They have to show almost at a criminal standard, maybe not quite a criminal standard, but they have the burden to show that the person should be denaturalized. So there's a lot of due process for people in federal court proceedings when the government is trying to take away their citizenship.
That's good to hear. And as the former employee of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, you represented ICE agents and provided legal counsel. Can you briefly tell us about who you saw coming into the U.S., what their needs were, and what the cases you were covering were about?
It's so diverse, and I think that's one of the things that I think some people, in particular, I think the Trump administration is missing, that there's such a world of difference between someone who just came into the United States in the past year, the past couple of years, and someone who's been here 25, 30 years, family ties, church ties, community ties. And in most ways, ICE is not treating them differently. If they come into ICE custody, they're not releasing them and they're deporting them. And so when I was with ICE, I would see all sorts of different cases. And a lot of the cases, we would advocate strenuously that people should be removed, that they were recent entrants or they were criminals or they were threats to the community. But what we could do, which the ICE attorneys and the ICE officers frankly can't do now because the administration won't let them, is exercise discretion and say, okay, you've been here 25 years, you have a pathway to get a green card, you've got a lot of family ties, we're not going to seek your removal. Right now, ICE is saying, sorry, we're going to detain you and we're going to deport you, and maybe we'll release you if the immigration judge orders you released or a federal judge orders you released. But absent that, we're just going to seek to remove you.
And what do you think led to them not having discretion now?
Well, in part, it was lax immigration enforcement by the Biden administration. The numbers were extraordinary, people who came across the southern border. And unfortunately, there was a counter reaction. It's sad. I think in some ways, I think Obama President Obama had sort of a good outlook on his immigration enforcement. We removed a lot of dangerous people during that time and removed a lot of people on the border. But maybe he went a little too far when he proposed DAPA, which would give perhaps 5 million people legal status, for example, the parents of people who came in under DACA. And that led in part, I think, to Donald Trump getting elected. And then I think in some ways he went too far to the right. For example, well, maybe the right is the wrong way to put it, but things like family separation and some of the travel bans, I think he went too far. And then I think that led President Biden to go too far to the left in different things that he did. And then again, now we have President Trump, I think, going too far the other way. So it's sad. I think immigration enforcement has often been this pendulum that has gone the extreme each way with each new administration.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this pendulum movement, especially when we're talking about individuals who have human dignity. In paragraph 1867, the Catechism states that the cry of the foreigner is one of the sins that cry out to heaven. As a Catholic and someone who has worked on these border issues, can you give us the bigger picture here about welcoming the stranger?
Yes, I mean, big picture, our society needs to revise the laws, I think, to allow a lot more people to come to the United States. It's good for our country to have many immigrants coming here. Our country is underpopulated. The birth rate is not high enough. So we need a lot more legal immigration and give people who are not criminals and have family ties and can contribute to our society, give them a pathway to come here. I think that the Catholic social doctrine, one of the principles of the Catholic social doctrine, is the universal destination of human goods. And the United States, as many of my clients will say, has so many goods, you know, employment, safety, the rule of law, freedom of religion, freedom of expression. And many countries don't have that. And so not simply as a matter of charity, but as a matter of justice, our country should allow a lot more people into the United States. I think we do need a good border. I think some of the things Trump has done have been over the top, like not letting people apply for asylum, for example. There's things we could do to have a border that would still respect people's right to apply for asylum. And I also think that this idea of solidarity, that, okay, sure, someone who's been here 20 years, they're here illegally, they're not a U.S. citizen, but they, at a deep level, they're part of the community.
Well, Paul, thank you for just bringing this thoughtful lens to the conversation. Cheers during the swearing-in ceremony of new U.S. citizens on July 4th. More than 100 people from 95 countries became Americans at their naturalization ceremony at President George Washington's Mount Vernon home in Alexandria, Virginia. It was one of many that happened across the country on our nation's 249th birthday. Former California governor and world-renowned actor Arnold Schwarzenegger was also in attendance to lay a wreath at George Washington's tomb. He offered words of encouragement to the newly sworn-in American citizens. And before we leave you, a congratulations to a pro-life business, 7 Weeks Coffee, that has reached a major milestone. The organization has now donated $1 million to more than 1,000 pro-life organizations across the country. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly interviewed the founder of this small business back in December. 7 Weeks' donation will provide more than 3 million diapers, nearly 26,000 cans of formula, and some 10,000 ultrasounds for mothers in need. Great work. Thank you for your pro-life witness to 7 Weeks Coffee. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.